Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Although he didn't coin the term microaggression, Dr. Darryl Wing-Su has literally written the book on the subject. Microaggression is the word used to describe hurtful, often subtle racial and ethnic slights. Su is a professor of psychology and education at Teachers College at Columbia University and the author of Microaggressions in Everyday Life. He visited Penn State to give a talk on microaggressions in higher education. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The word microaggression was first used in the 1970s by a Harvard University professor of education and psychiatry, but it was considered sort of academic speak. And it wasn't until 2007 when you popularized the term, first in an article and a few years later in your book, Microaggressions in Everyday Life. How do you define microaggressions? What are they?
Well, the microaggressions are the everyday slights and indignities, put-downs, and insults that well-intentioned people deliver to certain marginalized groups in our society. The thing that makes microaggressions so difficult to understand is that they are delivered unintentionally. That is, the person who conveys the put-down is unaware that they have done so.
Surprisingly, you say that these vague or disguised, even unintentional microaggressions are more harmful and more difficult for people of color to handle than an overt or obvious act of racism.
Yes, the overt racist is not the person who creates these inequities in education, employment, and health care. That is, that a Klan member, other than the fact that I wouldn't like to meet them individually by myself, they have less impact upon the quality and standard of my life than the well-intentioned employer who determines who they're going to give the job to the well-intentioned teacher who operates from stereotypes delivering towards students of color and towards healthcare providers who provide less than good quality care based upon their unawareness of the biases that they have. When they impact a person of color and the person of color tries to bring this out to the person's awareness, they will deny it. Now, it's not that they're lying, but indeed they do not see in what way that their statements are biased, prejudicial, or harmful, and they will respond by telling the person that they're simply oversensitive or they're misreading what is going on. And that response, by the way, is a microaggression in itself because
invalidating.
Yeah.
In fact, you break these microaggressions into three categories: micro assaults, micro insults, and micro invalidations. Give an example, if you can, of each one.
A micro assault is a conscious, deliberate, biased statement. It's most similar to old-fashioned racism. It's like calling a black individual the N-word. It's like calling gay lesbians the F-word. I mean, they're direct, and in some sense, there's no nonsense about that.
So there's nothing unintentional about that?
No, they're oftentimes deliberate, or they come out when the person has lost control. The other two forms, a micro insult and a micro invalidation, tend to operate outside the level of conscious awareness of the individual. A micro insult is something like, you know, seating an African American couple or a Latino couple and who come into the restaurant by the kitchen door.
When there are clearly much better seats available.
Yes, that's precisely it. A micro invalidation is generally something that denies the experiential reality of the person. A person of color who comes to you and say that, you know, such and such sent me a put down, and that person will say that, I think you're just oversensitive and misreading it. You're invalidating the experiential reality of the person.
One of the examples you give in your book is a black woman hearing somebody say, you don't even seem black.
Yes. Or you're pretty for a black girl.
So what's embedded in those messages?
Well, it's kind of like their perception that African Americans or blacks are negative, biased, undesirable, And they compliment it by saying that you're an exception. You're not like all the other black people that I know, or you're not like other Asians that I know. You're different. It allows a person to cling on to the negative stereotypes, but at the same time places the individual in a double bind.
You say that the person delivering this microaggressive comment often thinks that they're paying a person a compliment.
As an Asian American throughout my life, I've been complimented for speaking good English. And when I was younger, I always felt like, well, that's a compliment. But at the same time, why do I feel uncomfortable with that statement?
Well, what does it say to you?
It says to me that I'm a perpetual alien in my own country, that only true Americans look a certain way, that as an Asian American, someone born and raised in the United States, I continue to be an alien in my own country. Those are the meta communications, the hidden communications that are outside the level of the awareness of the person who is thinking that they are complimenting you.
You say that these everyday messages that people like yourself hear day in and day out throughout your life have a damaging impact on you psychologically and physically.
Yes.
Explain.
Well, we originally did a number of studies that explored the psychological impact of microaggressions upon people of color, upon women, upon LGBTQ populations. And we found that their cumulative nature that a person experiences day in and day out strikes at the very heart of their identity, their self-esteem, and it leads to feelings of anger, frustration, alienation, and results oftentimes in low self-esteem.
Your lifelong experiences really propelled you and one of your brothers, into this field to look at multicultural education, multicultural counseling, and the psychology of racism.
That's right. You know, when you're young and you're an only person of color in a primarily, like I was, in a primarily white school district.
In Portland, outside of
in
Portland.
In Portland, Oregon. Yeah, my brothers and I were the only Asians. And I remember all the way from overt forms of racism to subtle ones, the most damaging forms of bias to me when I was in the fourth or fifth grade, I noted that when the teacher taught social science or history, there was almost an absence of the Asian American contributions to the culture and history of the United States. I mean, they would talk about, you know, only a part of Western civilization and wouldn't cover things like the building of the Transcontinental Railroad by the Chinese, the mining of gold, the agricultural contributions of the Japanese. Now, when you're young, you don't realize that. You sit in class and you feel like there's a part of you not represented in the curriculum.
It's interesting, though, because African Americans have talked about being very uncomfortable in grade school when the discussion in history class was the transatlantic slave trade.
Yes.
And so they were hearing about the brutality of slavery, and they were the only black student sitting in the classroom. So it seems to me like it's a double-edged sword. You are damned if you do and damned if you don't.
It depends on how you present the history. And one of the things that I've noted is that when well-intentioned white teachers talk about African-American history, the enslavement of African-Americans, and so forth, they do it from a perspective that does not seem to really equate to the real-life experiences of what it means to be an African-American. For example, going back again to when the Asian-American experience, the only time the teacher would talk about Asians was when we studied a unit on China or Japan, and the teacher would say to me, "Darryl, what do you people celebrate when this Chinese event happens?" And my response would be, "I don't know. I mean, should I know?" You know, still the perception, the presentation of Asians was as an alien, a foreigner, not a true American. And I think that when you talk about the history of African Americans or enslavement, it is presented in a stereotypic, sanitized version that really doesn't connect with the real life experiences of a Black student.
You've said that we all have long-standing and instinctive attitudes and stereotypes toward other ethnic and racial groups, but your book is primarily directed to white Americans, although inter-ethnic racial microaggressions obviously do take place.
Yes, they do. One of the primary reasons why I talk about how white individuals deliver microaggressions. First of all, white Eurocentric ways of behaving and doing form the normative standards of our society. You know, Asian American culture doesn't form the normative standards of society. And that almost everything, you know, the textbooks, the history, comes from a white Euro-American perspective. Now, there's nothing wrong in that. But the issue is that it doesn't recognize and is imposed upon groups that are different, and it has great harms. There's a power imbalance that occurs as a result of it. But you are correct in saying that none of us, regardless of race, culture, ethnicity, gender, is immune from inheriting racial gender biases of our ancestors. And that is indeed, you know, a very important thing for us to look at as well.
You say that minorities tend to keep silent about these perceived slights. They don't say anything. Is that changing with our demographics? Minorities are expected to outnumber whites in the United States by 2042.
Actually, the changing demographics is going to probably happen decades earlier because the census notoriously undercounts people of color. But I do believe that people of color will, in several decades, will become a numerical majority. There is a difference between being a numerical majority and being a majority in terms of who holds the tools of power and influence. Remember, all we have to do is look at back in Africa, in South Africa, where a lot of times the people who were in the majority were Africans, and yet it was the whites who were minorities in numbers held the power. So the distinction has to be made between numerical majority and the minority that who holds the power and influence.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Dr. Darryl Wing Su, a professor of psychology and education at Teachers College at Columbia University. An Asian American, he has experienced the subtle and not-so-subtle put-downs known as microaggressions throughout his life. Those experiences influenced his research direction and lifelong work in the fields of multicultural education, multicultural counseling, and the psychology of racism and anti-racism. You know, on the other hand, if you look at the United States seems to me to be less xenophobic than so many other countries. You look at issues between Croats and Serbians, Ukrainians and Russians, Israelis and Arabs, for example.
You know, this is an interesting observation that you're making. When you talk about race and race relations, they differ from country to country. When we talk about racism in the United States, it's really perceived quite differently in other countries like Africa, China, Japan, Latin America. For example, to be labeled a racist in our society is one of the greatest, you know, abhorrent things that can happen. This is not necessarily true among Asians. For example, many Asians, the Chinese, oftentimes believe that they're superior over the Japanese. Yeah. And the Japanese aren't particularly bothered by it because they actually believe that they are superior over the Chinese. The thing that makes the United States so different is that we live in a society that values equity. We find a racism abhorrent. We teach our children about equality, equal access and opportunity. And that's on a conscious level. But on a subconscious, unconscious level, there's another curriculum that we're taught, and that teaching is that one group is better than the other. And when those two clash together, that's when you get turmoil. And that's why it's such a big issue in our society when sports figures make, you know, racist statements, or even politicians. In essence, the question becomes one of, can anyone be immune from being biased in some particular form?
And you say no.
No. In fact, there are socio-psychological studies that distinguish between implicit and explicit bias. Implicit bias is a bias that is outside your consciousness. Explicit bias is a type of bias we're all aware of, the stereotypes that we say we don't believe in them. But the implicit biases really affect one's behaviors, and they are unaware of it. For example, the Ferguson, city of Ferguson,
Missouri,
where they talk about the fact that these police officers may have operated from unconscious fears and biases that resulted in profiling and actual fear for their lives. They believe that African-American males are criminals, are violent.
Studies and apparently have shown that law enforcement will fire more shots at an African
and
criminal suspect than a white criminal suspect.
And their reaction time is different as well.
Because of fear.
Yes. And again, they're not aware of it. It's not that they're mean, evil people. It's the social conditioning that they have gone through that makes that so.
You say in order to overcome this, we need to raise awareness. But to address this at the college level among adults is to untrain us.
Mm-hmm.
And that K through 12 is where we really need this multicultural education.
That's right. There's a difference between what I call prevention and remediation. You know, you and I and most people, students in college, professors and adults have gone through a system that has socialized them into certain beliefs and attitudes, and those are deeply embedded in them. Much of it is unconscious, and those are the biases that lead to microaggressions that come out. For us to deal with them, it is a matter of unlearning. What are the situations that we need to create? If we talk just about higher education, what must happen at college campuses in order for them to unlearn these biases?
And to recognize that we have them.
Yes. See, that, by the way, that is indeed the first step. Because you
make the visible invisible, you say.
Because you can't really work on something if you don't think you're biased and the biases are invisible. So part of it really is exercise its experiences, classroom, campus activities that allow people to honestly explore their beliefs, attitudes, and biases that they have within them.
This may not be a good example. An experience happened to me that changed the way I park, for example. I once parked over a line in a very crowded parking lot in our office, and as a result got the nastiest note I've ever received tucked into my windshield. And I left. At first, I was just shocked that someone could spout such venom over a parking space.
Yes.
And then I thought, you know, because I was over that line, I prevented someone else from parking that day.
Yes.
And I've never parked without being conscious of being between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is that being conscious of these microaggressions works much the same way.
It does. That's a good analogy, because in some sense, when you become aware of what your biases are, it's very unpleasant and uncomfortable. I find, for example, that my students react very strongly, either through anger, defensiveness, or guilt, when you push racism into their consciousness. And it pains them to realize, once they get to that point, that they indeed have hurt others, oppressed others, stereotyped others, and it violates or assails their sense of being a good, moral, decent individual. But that is really the first step that occurs, and people will fight that.
How do you respond to critics who say that this term microaggression exaggerates the meaning of this encounter and it sees the person who was offended as a perpetual victim?
One of the things in 2007, when we published the taxonomy on microaggressions here.
When you say taxonomy, you mean the listing of things that could be...
The classification in terms of micro assaults, micro insults, and micro invalidations, and the common themes that come out of microaggressions. When I first published that in the American Psychologist in 2007, there were colleagues who wrote in who said that we were making a mountain out of a molehill, that we were portraying the people of color as weak and vulnerable, and that as white professors, they experienced everyday put-downs as well. It's not related to race. Well, we went back and did a number of studies that indicated that microaggressions, far from being slight and trivial, had massive impact upon people of color, and that when people of color were able to use the language of microaggressions, they felt empowered and freed rather than victimized and vulnerable, because for the first time they had a language to describe their experiential reality that many well-intentioned whites would say that you're oversensitive or paranoid. And that really was the key that we saw happening. If you talk to almost any people of color who have read or understand microaggressions, they would say it's so empowering.
You're describing what I've experienced.
Yeah. And I'm not crazy, as everyone seems to tell me I am.
You actually tell a very interesting story that illustrates this clash of realities. You talk about flying with an African-American colleague from New York to Boston,
yes.
And you were the first to board the plane, and you and your colleague chose seats in the front so that you could face one another, and they were very comfortable seats. And you were asked, after three white businessmen sat in the same section, you were asked by the flight attendant to move to the back of the plane.
Yes.
You saw that as being treated as a second-class citizen.
Yeah, that's precisely it. Here is where you get to the issue of whose reality is the real reality. My colleague of color and I immediately, experientially, knew it was a microaggression. And
Your blood pressure began to rise.
Yes,
Your face got red.
But the flight attendant, in all due respects, was not doing it consciously. She thought in her mind that her explanation, if I was to force and ask her why she asked us to move back, would have said
Which
that,
you did. She was insulted.
Yes. That she would have said that I was doing it for the good of the plane, to balance the weight on the plane. But the question also becomes, why did she not ask the men, the white men who came in, the same question? In fact, they came in after we did. Why not ask them?
To move to the back.
Yes. And, you know, here is where microaggressions become very difficult to deal with, because you can't prove it. You know, as passengers, we could never prove it. The only way we knew it was so was that this was not the first time we've experienced similar situations, and that in all of those situations, there would be different explanations, but for us, it was always that we were visible racial ethnic minorities. And that's the clash of racial realities that come into play here.
So how do you decide when it's worth responding, and what would be an appropriate response?
Well, you're asking a really important question in terms of things that deal with the mental health of individuals, because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. When I raised the issue with the flight attendant, she really thought that I was probably one of these oversensitive, overreacting people of color, and isn't that typical of them? If I decide that I shouldn't react because, one, I couldn't prove it, two, I know it would lead us nowhere in this particular flight, I oftentimes become very hard on myself. And I'll think to myself, how weak-willed are you? You know, why don't you stand up and bring this out? So you're in a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation. But we've become a series of studies now aimed at how can people of color respond in a functional, healthy way to microaggressions. And the first rule that we've come out with is take care of yourself first. You can't educate someone when you're pained and hurt. So taking care of yourself becomes the first thing. And then secondarily, how do you raise that issue in a way that is educational for the flight attendant or the person who has delivered the microaggression?
In your clash of realities, you did say something. Her response was not satisfactory, and you spent the remaining of your travel time seething at some level.
Yeah.
So my question is, if she had said, I apologize, I didn't think of that when I moved you, but you've raised an important issue to me, and I will think of that in the future, would that have changed your physical and psychological response?
It would definitely. That is really a response that tends to connect her with me. And I think my response would say, thank you. I really appreciate your openness and honesty.
And instead, she was defensive.
Yes.
I was not being racist when I moved you and your partner.
In fact, her statement was that I don't see color at all, which got me even more angry and upset.
Funny because you consider this statement of color blindness another form of a microaggression.
Yes.
Why?
Well, color.
Because it's not possible to be true?
It's not. You know, if you look at all the social psychological studies, what is it? Gender and race are the most ingrained things that people from childhood automatically recognize.
See.
To say that you don't see me as an Asian American means that you're denying an intimate aspect of my identity. Yes, I'm an individual, and yes, we are all human beings, but I'm also an Asian American, and I want you to acknowledge the holistic aspect of me.
How optimistic are you that the tide is changing, that talking about these microaggressions is creating more awareness and could result in positive change?
I'm very optimistic. Not particularly in terms of whether the trainings that we're doing now will have a major impact, but as our society becomes much more multicultural, as we begin to build in multicultural courses from pre-K through 12 and take a preventive measure, I think our younger kids will become less and less biased. I mean, if you look at the baby boomers, the X generation, and the millennials, you're seeing progressively less bias expressed by the younger generation than the older ones. And this really comes out strongly in sexual orientation. You see the changes occurring. And I'm hopeful that it's going to take a long time, but I'm hopeful that there are enough people who will join us in this journey to make our society truly one of equal access and opportunity.
And on that note, we're out of time. Thank you so
much
for talking with us. Our guest was Dr. Daryl Wing Su, Professor of Psychology and Education at Teachers College at Columbia University. He's the author of 18 books, including Microaggressions in Everyday Life. For more information on our guest and this topic, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.